Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Spinning the Reel. I'm your host, Evan.
And I'm your host, Zach.
I will say right off the top here, I'm just getting over like a cold or something here, so pardon my scratchy voice during this episode, but we're excited to do a show because today, as we record on Tuesday, January 24th, the Oscar nominations have been released. So we're going to break down some of the categories, some of the surprises, what we're excited about, what we've seen, what we haven't, all that kind of stuff. And then from there, Zach, where are we taking things?
We are talking Regal Mystery Movie, actually. Missing. So this is a sort of spiritual successor, I guess. Not necessarily a direct sequel to Searching from...
Definitely in-universe.
Yeah. I don't even remember what year Searching came out. 2018,
maybe?
Yeah. Which just released this past week, and we happened to see an early preview of, but now that it's out, we're going to go ahead and talk about it.
Yep, and then in between, we are going to be doing our first Sundance review, as our tickets became good today for online Sundance. And then what are we going to do after that, Cody?
Cody.
Oh, shit.
Cody, are you here?
Cody's not here again. Damn. All right, we miss you, Cody. Next week, hopefully.
Well, that's the show. I mean, we're doing... Oscar noms, we'll talk about our first Sundance feature, and then Missing.
And then Missing. Let's dive right in. All right, Zach, we are going to lead things off with the news of the day in the film world, and that is the Oscar nominations. So I think Best Picture mostly kind of came down the way people seem to sort of be expecting it to. A few surprises in there. So do you want to run off the list? Do you have it handy? I can do it if you need.
Best Picture list?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So we have All Quiet on the Western Front, Avatar, The Way of Water, The Banshees of Inisherin, Elvis, Everything Everywhere All at Once, The Fablemans, Tar, Top Gun Maverick, Triangle of Sadness, and Women Talking.
Yeah, okay. So I think people might have thought of All Quiet on the Western Front as maybe a little bit of a surprise getting in there, but it's been gaining so much momentum lately with other awards bodies and things like that, that it almost seemed like a lock going into today. So really the surprises on the day seem to be Triangle Sadness, which I don't know was really on too many radars for like a Best Picture nomination.
Yeah, definitely didn't see a lot of buzz about it outside of film Twitter, etc.
Right, but you know, every single director that I've seen on film Twitter has just gushed about the movie Triangle of Sadness.
It's a good movie.
They think it's brilliant. Like, yeah. We talked about this on an episode before, but you get a little bit of class satire in front of some directors these days, and they just fall in love with it. So I guess you can't be that surprised.
Yeah, I mean, it's witty, it's subversive, it's anti-capitalist.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, so that was, I guess, a little less surprising to me than Women Talking getting in, a movie that I think absolutely deserves to be not only in the conversation for Best Picture, but like towards the front of it. I think it's one of the better movies that was made this year, but it's not one that has gotten a lot of attention. It's not one that got really many other nominations. So,
well, I mean, it really just is underseen, I think,
yeah,
at this point. I think it just expanded, right? But before that, it was only showing in like select theaters in LA, at least near us. So if you think of, you know, the average viewer, it's almost inaccessible. Not a lot going for it in at least accessibility. Certainly an excellent picture, and deserving of the nomination. I think there's a lot of interesting choices how the story is like structured, and how the women talking in this movie truly are like centered, you know. There's very little distractions.
Yeah, it's interesting. We'll get to the acting nominations in a minute, but it's interesting to see that a movie like that, like Women Talking, that is so character focused. I mean, there's a big idea, obviously, at the center of Women Talking, but it's so carried by the performances throughout it that it's kind of interesting to see it get a Best Picture nomination, but nothing in the acting categories, nothing in directing, anything like that. So
yeah, that is actually pretty interesting, given that what you said to me at least rings true about, because there's not a lot of plot in this movie, right?
Right.
It's mostly performances and dialogue, all very well done. So it is interesting that as a whole, as the sum of its parts, it's recognized as one of the best of 2022, but no one is individually like singled out.
Right. And there's some good performances in there, like Jesse Buckley, yeah, Rooney Mara, and
literally any of them that I guess you could feature as like a, you know, the lead role. Jesse Buckley definitely being one of them.
Right. Claire Foy
is
in that conversation too. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. I think maybe the most surprising name that
they
fell
didn't
out
nominate Ben Whishaw as an actor in a supporting role and none of the women.
Man, like, it really feels like that's something the Academy would do like 5 years ago. Be like, let's nominate the one man
in
Women Talking.
In its infinite wisdom.
God, yeah. I think maybe the surprising omission from the list, I guess, that struck me as I kind of look at it right now is The Whale. That was one that was garnering a lot of attention, obviously, for Brendan Fraser, but seemed like it might have had enough support to kind of push it over the line. But it does feel like kind of a divisive movie a little bit. Just in terms of reaction. So
yeah, I think that is definitely one I've seen mixed reviews on. Personally, I like that one quite a bit. But most of the support that I have seen is like you said, just gushing for Brendan Fraser's performance and sort of this is like his comeback story, you know, his resurgence role. So it's cool to see him get the nod. But yeah, definitely not one that I am sort of puzzled that it's not on the Best Picture list.
Was there anything that you were puzzled didn't make the cut?
The Batman.
Batman.
Zack Snyder's Justice League. God. No.
Was that even this year?
No. No.
It's every year.
Yeah.
That movie is
like
eternal.
That's just one that they'll have to rewrite the Academy rules to, you know,
we'll get there, you know. Our letter campaign is in full force.
Well, this is maybe getting a little bit ahead, but it's cool to see Paul Mescal get the nomination. But
let's jump over to that side.
Not Aftersun again getting it.
Not surprising. I don't know.
It's not like a Best Picture movie, even though it's so fucking good.
It is so good. And he is
my number one of the year.
And I think there was some question about, like, who would be that extra guy in the Best Actor field, because it did sort of seem like Austin Butler, Colin Farrell, Brendan Fraser were, like, locks, and Bill Nighy always kind of seemed to be in that mix as well. So Paul Mescal being the guy instead of, like, I don't know who else it would have been, like Gabriel LaBelle or something from The Fabelmans. Doesn't seem like there's been a ton of support for that movie based on the nominations here. But yeah, Paul Mescal getting in is
what's the guy's
pleasant
is it Diego Calva?
Never was a chance for that one, I'm afraid.
Are you kidding me? That single tear shed at the end of the movie.
God, what a film,
Travesty.
Babylon.
Which took away its fair share of nominations here.
It did. So I guess actor in a leading role went sort of the way we thought it might go. We should point out that Everything Everywhere All at Once, most nominations of any movie.
Yeah, absolutely. 11, the runner-ups being All Quiet on the Western Front and Banshees tied at 9.
Right. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the actresses first, because I think that's a good lead-in from Everything Everywhere All at Once. And then we can talk about some of the bigger films and stuff. So leading actress, Cate Blanchett as Lydia Tarr, of course.
Most deserved.
Yep. Ana de Armas in Blonde is kind of the surprise.
That's
here,
a blind spot for me, but yeah, absolutely. I think I don't know anyone that was expecting an Ana de Armas nod for this one. I feel like the movie is mostly despised, honestly.
Yeah, it's a pretty grating movie. Like, it is, I don't know, exploitative has been thrown around by some critics, and I don't know if I'd go that far, but it's definitely not, I don't know, it's not the best like biopic I've seen in a while. And Ana de Armas, though, is, it's interesting. Her performance is unusual for a biopic, because it's not like the example jumping to my head right now is like Rami Malek in
that's always your example.
Yeah, in Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yep.
And the reason is because they like did a lot of work to kind of try and transform Rami Malek into Freddie Mercury, tried to make him look as much like Freddie Mercury as they could and make him sound like him as much as they could, the whole thing. Ana de Armas, and there was like some controversy around this at the time, is that like Ana de Armas is a Cuban actress and she doesn't quite do the Marilyn Monroe voice, right? And I think it's fine, because what she does is she captures the spirit of Marilyn Monroe, like the sort of elusiveness of her as like an on-screen persona, and then like also shifting between that and like the real person. So I think the performance is really incredible, but the movie is failing her in a lot of ways there.
Yeah. I don't know if I'll get to that one. We'll see.
It's a long movie, too. It's like 2.5 on Netflix. Andrea Riseborough in To Leslie, a movie that I'm only aware of because I had heard some chatter like on film Twitter and stuff the last few days that she was making up some ground in this conversation. And, you know, I want to watch it now, but...
Yeah, that's another blind spot for me. Not many amongst all of these nominations, but yeah. To Leslie, I think the Bill Nye Living, I haven't seen.
And then where are you going to see it? You
all know? Quiet.
It's playing in limited release.
Yeah.
And then the two other locks coming in, Michelle Williams in The Fablemans, and Michelle Yeoh getting in for Everything Everywhere All at Once. Not really so much a surprise anymore, but...
No, I think there was a pretty heavy campaign for that one. And a lot of like positive critical and audience reception for Everything Ever All at Once. Right. Quite a beloved film of the last year. And so that there was a huge push, I think, for her to at least get the nomination. And now secured.
Yeah. All right. What about actor in a supporting role?
Actor in a supporting role. So we have Brendan Gleeson here in Banshees of Inisherin, Brian Tyree Henry in Causeway. Judd Hirsch in The Fablemans, Barry Keoghan in Banshees, and Keoi Kwan in Everything Everywhere All at Once. What a fun field.
Yeah. Glad Brian Tyree Henry is getting some recognition. Not a movie I've seen. Have you seen Causeway?
No. Does not look interesting at all.
No, but I've heard he's great in it. And
he's a good actor.
He's a good actor.
This could have been Bullet Train, honestly.
God. What was he? Was he Lemon. He was Lemon, that's right.
What a tragic...
It does seem like we're tragic sort fate. Of in for a little heavyweight bout here between Barry Keoghan and Keoi Kwan, but at least the way I look at it.
Man, I mean, Barry Keoghan and Brendan Gleeson both in Banshees give incredible performances. Right. I feel like Barry's is a little bit more...
It's flashier.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good word for it. I was going to say charismatic, but flashier is definitely the right word. And he does that. There's such a physicality to his character and the way he plays it that is, magnetic and just like,
yeah,
it's, you can't look away from this guy at how, you know, just how stupid he is, I guess. But I don't know. I
should have nominated him for, the Batman.
There we go. It's crazy that Judd Hirsch got in this, I think. Given, like, his role in The Fablemans, while...
I do think some of that movie does kind of turn on the conversation that he has with Sammy.
Oh, yeah, it's an incredibly important scene.
But I don't know that I would put it as, I don't know, a more impressive performance than, like, Paul Dano in The Fablemans.
Right.
I have to clarify that.
I was going to say, yeah.
Even, like, Seth Rogen is giving an interesting performance in that movie, too, so... I like Judd Hirsch in it, though. I thought he...
Oh, yeah, excellent.
That's a real good scene.
He's that moment in the trailer. He's like, love... Or no, he's like, family, art, tear you apart, right?
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, a good scene. I don't know, right. not so much a robust performance, just a couple of minutes of screen time.
Right.
Over a dinner and, like, a sleepover. But, yeah, interesting to me that he got in here for that. But definitely would have loved to see a Paul Dano nomination.
Yeah. Let's see. Actress in a supporting role. Angela Bassett in Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, who honestly might be the front runner here. I'm not entirely sure. But Hong Chau in The Whale. Not The Menu. Menu might have been a better choice, I think.
I don't. Well, yes, maybe. I don't know. I think in The Whale, she's giving more of like an Oscar performance.
I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, The Whale's like, I wouldn't go so far as to call The Whale Oscar bait, but it's definitely a movie that's like an Oscar movie.
There's some Oscar considerations going on in
yeah,
that movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But Hong Chau is excellent. She's one of the best parts of the movie. And
yeah,
her, certainly her performance as well. It's awesome to see her get a nod.
Yeah, it's super cool. Carrie Condon in The Banshees of Inisherin. Jamie Lee Curtis in Everything Everywhere All at Once. And the one that I think everyone's been kind of banging the drum for but hadn't really shown up on a lot of these nomination lists is Stephanie Soo for Everything Everywhere All at Once. Awesome. Like, I think she is... I love Jamie Lee Curtis in Everything Everywhere All at Once, but I feel like Stephanie Soo is the one that, like, is really... If you talk about a supporting performance that's, like, even bordering on lead, that, like, is, I don't know, impressive.
Yeah.
Kind of carries that film.
Yeah, it's absolutely. Hers. Again, another incredibly, like, physical role.
Mm-hmm.
And she's in all kinds of, like, fun costumes. And there's so many moments where her performance is maybe dominating is not the word, but it's, like, her on-screen presence is... magnificent,
right?
You know, it's just
threatening,
it's
and vulnerable
so
at the same time.
Yeah, just, you know, like
maybe the best Elvis performance of the year.
Yeah, her first reveal as a villain, you know, as like the villain, quote unquote, of the movie, you know, and then I just think of that final sequence where it's like a kung fu fight, right? Like it's a kung fu sequence, but.
Right.
What's really happening is she's trying to like force her way into oblivion and her mom's trying to hold her back.
Yeah.
And just when she like she's in this costume and makeup that's like a half of her face is happy and the other half is like sad.
Mm-hmm.
And she just turns and like looks at Michelle Yeoh this way that's just so devastating. And she's just like, it's time to just like let me go. Incredible.
Right.
And then even just their smaller sequences too. Definitely, I think the original announcement was, you know, when it was originally announced that they were submitting Jamie Lee Curtis for consideration as well as like Stephanie Soo,
right.
Was like, huh? Like Jamie Lee Curtis, funny, but
yeah.
Really?
Also an important part of the movie, but not to nearly the same degree.
Yeah, not at all.
Yeah.
Not even close. Definitely probably the one that could be something else here, maybe even something from like Women Talking, you know,
right,
or something like that. But I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis, cool.
Yeah, love Jamie Lee Curtis. So I think that's a good time to kind of jump over to the bigger picture of, you know, Everything Everywhere All at Once. It's I don't know, it's so cool to see that, you know, I don't know, this movie came out in March, right? Everything Everywhere All at Once, something like that, March or April?
April, I think.
Yeah, and so it seemed like a silly... Yeah, I mean, the movie is kind of inherently silly, right? It's about, like, jumping dimensions, and, you know, there's a lot of dildos in the movie and, like, butt plugs and things like that.
Yeah,
just, like,
yeah.
It's a silly movie. I don't think, as much as it was getting, like, rave reviews and all that, I don't think there was ever really a feeling that come this time, like, come January of 2023, that this would be the movie leading in nominations at the Academy Awards. And I think it sort of speaks to how, I don't know, how far the Academy's come in sort of diversifying its tastes a little bit. Like, this is not what you would consider an Oscar bait movie, but Everything Everywhere All at Once is like undoubtedly one of the best movies of the year. So I think it's really cool that it is getting all of the attention that it is in pretty much across the board. I mean, the Daniels got a directing nomination for this too. Like, that's
yeah.
Awesome. Like,
mm-hmm.
These are the guys that made the Daniel Radcliffe corpse farting movie, and like here they are now at the Oscars, Best Picture nominees, and like that's super cool. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about Everything Everywhere All at Once being the nomination leader?
Yeah, definitely a surprise, right? Like I mentioned, sort of closer to the beginning of this segment, a beloved film, certainly among Spinning the Reel crew.
Sure.
And film lovers in general, as far as online and even, you know, aggregate websites like IMDb or Rotten Tomatoes or whatever.
Yeah.
Right, this movie's got just about nothing but positive reception. But when you look at it, and like you say, how sort of silly it is on its face, you would be hard pressed to find someone who would, you know, be like, yeah, this is absolutely going to be the sweep, you know, the clear front runner at the Academy Awards this season. But at the same time, it's so fucking cool that it is,
like, right?
You know, if movies are dying and this is the last gasp, it's a hell of a gasp.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. I'm just dreading what the pushback winner next season is going to be after, you know, we have Parasite and then
what's
Green
the next
Book.
Green Book?
Right, yeah, like, what's the next Green Book that we're getting? The next two in the list, you know, I don't really feel the need to talk too much about Banshees of Inisherin. We've talked about it a bit on this podcast before, a movie we both like a lot, and I would love to see Colin Farrell take home leading actor. I think actually now that Paul Mescal's in the group, I think I might be rooting for him, but Colin Farrell is so good in that movie. But All Quiet on the Western Front. So I know you haven't seen this movie yet, but to me it is really interesting, I guess is maybe the word, that this is the movie that has sort of broken through into Best Picture, not even just from Netflix. Like, I would have put Pinocchio or something, or even Glass Onion ahead of it. But I don't know. Like, I want you to see it before, I guess, we get too much into it. But this is, of course, an adaptation of the classic novel All Quiet on the Western Front. I think the first time it's being done in the German language. And it's, like, quite the production. I think most of its nominations, All Quiet, came from sort of like the Batman categories, if you will, the technical side of things,
yeah,
you know,
categories.
Visual effects and production design and that sort of thing.
Cinematography, it's also up for.
Yeah, undoubtedly worthy of those nominations, I think. But just as a film on its, like, overall merits, I wasn't as moved by this as, like, the 1940.
The 1940 adaptation?
Yeah, the 1940 adaptation of the book that also won Best Picture. I'm not saying this is going to win Best Picture, but it's, I don't know, there's like a depth to that film that I didn't experience watching this one. It's just more of like a modern war movie, you know, that like really uses cinema in that way.
Like the 1917 of this year or something?
That's kind
of
how I felt about it. Like, okay. Not as gimmicky, I guess, as 1917.
How dare you?
Like, again, 1917, I think, works on its own merits, too, but...
Roger Deakins up again for another Oscar as well.
Another Sam Mendes film.
Yep.
Yeah, but, I don't know. That so much of that movie was dependent and, like, I don't know. Part of the reason that movie was beloved was because it was that one-shot cinematography, right? Like...
I mean, yeah, sure. The hidden cuts and like the no editing gimmick, to use your word, helped. But I think it's just a beautiful film to look at otherwise.
Yeah. I don't think that movie, you know, I don't remember if it led in nominations or it certainly came close.
Yeah, it was high up there.
Yeah.
Because it was in almost every, I think it was in every technical category.
Right.
And then Best Picture, Best Directing.
Right. And I don't know if it's that without the, you know, illusion of the one take kind of thing. And this movie isn't so much built on that, but you can see the support isn't quite as robust here because I don't believe it got a directing nomination, which I believe it did at the BAFTAs. So instead they went with, I think Spielberg was out at the BAFTAs. He's back in here. Ruben Östlund getting a directing. Why don't we just talk about the directing, too?
Yeah, that's the one major category we haven't covered.
Yeah, so Martin McDonagh, Banshees, Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, Steven Spielberg, The Fabelmans, Todd Field, Tar, and Ruben Östlund, Triangle of Sadness. They love their international directors, that one slot they kind of save for them, and Ruben Östlund gets in. I don't know. I have a hard time saying a bunch of glowing things about Triangle of Sadness because it's a movie I didn't really think was as effective as, I don't know, some of its biggest fans do. But, you know, I like Ruben Östlund. I think he's a good director, but I just don't think it's his best work.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, Triangle of Sadness pretty good. A bit feels a bit ironic, I suppose.
Yeah.
That you know, the Academy is holding up this film that's like sort of about them.
Right.
You know, like, it's good to see. I think it is a well directed film. I have no qualms about anyone in this directing category, to be honest, this year. Martin McDonagh up again. I think this is his second nomination. Did he get a directing nod?
I'm sure he did for Three Billboards.
Billboards.
Yeah, he must have.
Mm-hmm. Daniel Kwan and the Daniels. It's so funny. I can't remember. I think it's the Turn Down for What music video that they directed. Okay. Or something. Like, these guys, these are the guys that are up for best directing at the Academy. Like,
that's incredible.
That's so fucking
and
cool.
Honestly, they probably should win it. Like, it's a magic trick to be able to take that movie and turn it into something that is so emotionally impactful. Like, I don't think anyone else has corralled their material into a more, I don't know, pointed film than they did. Like, I would probably out of that field say that's the best directed movie.
Yeah, certainly one of the greatest achievements to make a movie. As we've said on this show alone already, silly, right? It's mm-hmm. it's just they're kind of corralling these these concepts and making them palatable and accessible in a way that's funny and entertaining and like some actually pretty technically difficult compositions and yeah. sequences, right? Like,
I mean, it's
just in terms of
some
like,
of the best action choreography too. I mean, I know that's not just on the director, but you know, like weaving that into your story too. Like, it's not something that gets put in movies anymore. Like, I don't know. People all talked about Damien Chazelle bringing tap dancing back into movies and stuff with like La La Land, but like these guys did. They brought back like kung fu action sequences into major blockbusters, and that's like cool.
Yeah, hell yeah.
So, yeah, I love that. Anything else in here that, like, I don't know, speaks to you? Anything that bothers you? I will say the Elvis film editing nomination is not surprising. That's a category that always sort of leans towards the most editing. Definitely, I think, the case there.
Definitely, like, so, I mean, Elvis is horrifically edited.
I agree.
It is. Oh man, it's borderline offensive in some cases. And honestly, I will die on the hill that Spencer was snubbed.
Yeah.
And this year, I think that film would be Decision to Leave. Decision to Leave.
Oh yeah.
Some of the best
editing across the board.
Some of the best editing I've ever seen in my life, you know, because I think most the sort of kind of general accepted like rule, so to speak, is that editing you don't notice is like the best editing, and then on the other side of that coin would be like intentional editing, that is noticeable on purpose to either serve a thematic point, you know, or to make you, I guess, to make you question or consider what the film is trying to do with that choice is something that like what makes editing good. And the power of editing is often misunderstood or underappreciated. And I think Decision to Leave being out of this category is
tragic. Especially because it is such intentional editing, like it is editing that you notice, which is sort of a prerequisite for getting into
this
category.
But yeah, it's like doing this sleight of hand thing too, right? Where yeah,
but it's you doing it in an effective way, not doing it in an in your face way.
Yeah, the editing is intentional and you're meant to notice, you know, it's meant to be like this almost dreamlike sequence mm-hmm. or state a lot of times, but it's also doing it in a way that's seamless, that feels fluid and natural, that isn't like jarring. You're not like, oh wait, was that a dream or something like that? You're like, you're completely in this character's shoes every single time.
Right. Yeah, incredible. And that's one that I think is sort of a shocking omission from the, if I'm reading this right, yeah, the Best International Feature did not include that. We just watched Broker the other day, another movie that seemed like it was going to be, you know, really in the running for that. I haven't seen all of the international features, but those ones seem like they were going to be, I don't know, contenders.
Is All Quiet gonna recreate Parasite's success? Because I think Parasite is the only film that's been up for international and Best Picture and got both.
I don't think that's true. I think there was got both. I don't know if All Quiet's gonna get both. It's tough without the director nomination, but you never know. I mean, it could be just one of those things that people are just coming around to. It's on Netflix. Everyone's seeing it. Man, I hope not.
What are going to be like some of the surprises on the Variety article this year? Because they always talk to someone that's like, oh, yeah, I just voted for this because I know the guy.
Oh, my God. The mystery ballot or whatever. Yeah. Who knows, man. It's going to be so funny. I will say, just having rewatched the Top Gun Maverick today, Hold My Hand, terrible song.
That's up for original song.
Yeah, does not deserve to be in there. All right, anything else nomination related that you want to touch on?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. Those are all the major categories. I think as it gets closer to the, you know, leading up to the actual Academy Awards, we'll do like a full rundown. There's still some blind spots,
Make
I think.
Make our predictions or whatever.
Yeah, we'll do our predictions. And then I think, you know, we'll probably do another audience submission form that we usually do.
All right, Zach, we are checking back in from the future. We are sitting here getting ready for day two of Sundance, and we wanted to do a little check-in in the middle of this episode about the first movie that we saw at Sundance. That's a little movie called Magazine Dreams, starring Jonathan Majors, having a big year this year. He's going to be in Creed 3. He's going to be in Quantumania. Kind of the face-ish of the new next saga of Marvel.
Yeah.
Seems like, so.
The next Thanos.
Big things in store for this guy. But we watched a little Sundance number called Magazine Dreams, directed by Elijah Bynum. Do you want to try and explain what this movie is?
Yeah, okay. So this movie is the story of a man. What is his name? It's Killian, that's right.
Something. Killian Maddox.
Killian Maddox, yeah. He is a young black man with aspirations of being a famous bodybuilder, hence the title Magazine Dreams. That is an extremely simple plot description, given what actually unfolds in this movie.
Right.
Just, I guess, without spoiling it off the top.
I'm not sure it's entirely spoilable.
I mean, it's definitely spoilable.
I mean, there's some things that happen, but like...
Yeah, so to give you an idea, that plot on the surface can sound like anything, right? It could sound like a, you know, like one of those classic like underdog stories where, you know, like the original Rocky or something. Or even just more a character study or like an exploration of...
What drives someone to get to that,
yeah, like, something like I think like a Whiplash almost.
Sure.
This is produced, so this was produced or one of the producers is Dan Gilroy, who directed Nightcrawler.
Yep.
And that influence is very, very present here. It's a film is disturbing to say the least. Not only in his depictions of like the how he treats his body, like
right,
but also just the events that happen, like
right,
the actual plot beats. It's very clear that Killian Maddox is not someone who is mentally stable.
Yep.
We first meet him. He is in a therapy session, and what appears to be court mandated. For some sort of maybe aggravated assault. I don't remember.
Yeah, I think it was somebody at some bodybuilding event or something tried to touch him, and he said he doesn't like to be touched. And he
he was in the hospital, and the nurses were.
Oh, that's right, the nurses. Something. And he said to them, "What was the line?" He said to them, "I'm gonna split your skull open and drink your brains like soup."
Yeah. Yes. And in that moment, it's played for comedy. Yeah. You know, but we come to find out like how serious,
like how close to the edge he is to doing something like that. Yeah.
Honestly, this movie. I guess just jumping into like talking about it beyond what it's actually about, I feel is not as deep in exploration as I was expecting, especially with some of the praise that I've heard, for the movie. I think this exists entirely on the back of Jonathan Majors. Like his performance is insane with how good it is. This is like, you know, some Daniel Day-Lewis shit.
Unbelievably committed to playing an absolutely unhinged character. You know?
Right.
Like, almost entirely detached from reality around him.
It is uncomfortable to watch. It's so uncomfortable to watch him just break social conventions, like, without even realizing it. You know, he's very socially inept.
Right.
And I'm sure... socially, like, underdeveloped,
right.
Which is not not much background is given other than he's an orphan, so you assume he had some kind of difficult childhood,
right?
And he just becomes obsessed with this idea of achieving some sort of perfection in his mind.
Yeah, I think it's maybe more about the way, at least the read I had about it is, you know, he lost his parents at a young age in like a very traumatic fashion. I won't get into it here, but like really disturbing stuff just off the hop right there.
Right, yeah.
And the way I read it is that like he wanted to commit himself to like sculpting his body into a way that he'd be admired and he'd be remembered and he'd be wanted in a way, and that like he ends up finding throughout the course of this movie that it's not about like achieving something greater. It's not about, you know, building yourself to an unhealthy or unstable or, you know, this ideal of perfect. It's about forging connections with people and like the people around you. And I'm not sure, this is where I'm not sure the movie's very successful, because I'm not sure that Killian ever really gets to that point either, or the movie ever really directs its energy towards like one way or another, whether that's a good or a bad thing. Like, I mean, I guess it kind of says it's a bad thing, but like it never really commits to any sort of idea about it. It just kind of throws ideas at you. And so that's where I sort of agree that like this is a movie that has a lot on its mind, but isn't like structured enough necessarily to realize that. And so it does sort of just fall to the performance, which is captivating even when the movie feels a little bit out of reach.
Yeah, I think it really, I don't know if it's afraid of itself. I mean, this is terrifying, but it seems like a pretty straightforward narrative of a person's sort of unraveling. And nothing's really going his way, and you know, he wants to reclaim his power, so to speak, and goes in a direction that's sort of culturally prevalent, and you know, a divisive issue. But then it takes a huge step backwards at the end, in my opinion.
Yep.
Just completely like is trying to dip its toe in the water here, and then gets right back out, giving
almost
this
gratuitous at the end there, because it really, like you said, it's not accomplishing anything for the narrative of the story by like backtracking on. I don't know. I'm trying to talk about it without talking about it.
Yeah,
in too much detail.
Sort of. Yeah, you sort of get this moment that, is you get, well, you get a lot of foreshadowing.
He fully
right?
crosses the line,
yeah,
you know, at the end.
Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, either it's kind of weird. I guess that it is a little bit open to interpretation, or your reading of the film. You can say that it becomes confusing what is real at a certain point, and you can think of it as the way the movie is telling you what the movie is saying is real, right. And then maybe that's not actually what's happening in with the character, and the last part isn't real. It's doing this sort of
right
doing this sort of Joker thing, much better than Joker, in my opinion.
I agree.
At least a little bit more captivating. And truly, I cannot overstate how much of a force of acting Jonathan Majors is. Like
that sequence where he goes on a date with Haley Bennett's character one of the most awkward, uncomfortable sequences I've ever seen in a movie. It's just like you can't look away, but it's like a slow motion train wreck. But I was gonna say one of the wild things about Online Sundance is for some reason they don't include Q&As on all of the movies. Some of them they do, some of them they don't. This was one where they did not include the Q&A. I went on YouTube and found someone that had recorded it in person.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, the questions were terrible. Like, it was just literally the audience members were asking, like, was it intentional when you put that poster in the background? And he was like, no. And then there was another question that was like, was it intentional when you did this? And he's like, yeah, that one I did on purpose. Like, ask better questions, guys.
Yeah.
But one of the things that came up was Taylor Page is in this movie as a sex worker. And one of the questions had to do with like her limited screen time if there was another scene with her in the movie. And what the director, Elijah Bynum, was saying is that there was another scene with her, but he felt like it came out late because he felt like this whole movie is sort of a tightrope to keep you on board with this character, Killian, because he does do a lot of things in this movie that are disturbing, off-putting. But there's also like this force drawing you back that like this guy has been through a lot of shit and is like punishing himself to a degree too. So it is sort of a tightrope that this movie is watching, trying to keep you from like totally giving up on this character, seeing him as irredeemable. And I think, again, most of that falls onto Jonathan Majors, is just like a force of acting, kind of keeping you on his side for as long as he possibly can until the end. So just to tie it all back together, I think what you're talking about at the end there, it does sort of deflate the movie because it has spent this entire time trying to keep you on this ride with a character that is inherently flawed at best. And then at the end, it still isn't willing to commit one way or another. Is it like you should be with this character still, or you should have given up on him, or you should have like, yeah, you know, like this is not a good guy or whatever at the end, but they're not really willing to commit to that one way or another. So I think it is kind of a detractor.
Right. Yeah. There's no payoff. It, really, the movie starts out rather slow and just builds tension, you know, right, the rest of the time that you're watching this film. It's like the screws are slowly, slowly turning, and then they start turning a little bit faster, and then like, oh shit. Okay,
and then they turn too much.
Yeah,
and then they turn them back a bit.
But yeah, so it really is uncomfortable and filled me at least with a sense of dread for what was going to happen with this character and how Killian's story was going to come to an end. And then it just doesn't do that. It gives about a sort of a half depiction before taking a big step back. And then ending on this like voiceover of that's like hopeful and, you know, I'm going to be better kind of thing.
Right.
But
still pursuing the same sort of path.
Yeah, kind of like, fuck the haters, but like, what? That's not...
Yeah, that was never, you know, the point.
Yeah, and there have to be some sort of consequences. I don't know. It just...
Yeah.
Yeah, a bit of a flaccid ending, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. They definitely didn't stick it. I don't know, and I do think there are so many interesting ideas about, you know, what people put themselves through to perform for other people, what grief can cause someone to, like, push themselves to. There's obviously the ideas of race and the police in this movie, too. Like,
right.
Killian has multiple interactions. I think multiple interactions with police in the movie. There's the sequence where he is running and a police car goes by, and there's a sequence where he gets the police called on him.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously in that case, justifiable like concern of like the people in a restaurant that he's kind of like harassing. Maybe, you know, I'm not going to advocate for calling the police on anybody, but I don't know. It's never really followed through with to any like full degree, you know, right. Like it's just ideas existing in this movie that, I don't know, entirely work.
Yeah. There's a lot of themes present here. Toxic masculinity being mm-hmm. one of the big ones.
Yeah, that's true too.
Mental health and, you know, stigma around people who don't necessarily follow social conventions, mm-hmm. Because they don't know how. It's not clear whether he is like a person with autism or
right.
You know what his actual mental health situation is like. Obviously, he's in therapy. He has a lot of aggressive behaviors.
Right.
He can't regulate his emotions very well. He doesn't understand social cues. So, some of those kinds of things that you know imply something like that.
Right.
Plus, yes, being a young black man and of his size and stature, as he carries himself,
yeah,
you know,
there's themes of like power and exploitation too when it comes yeah. to his like his
and
idol
even
and
celebrity and you know
yeah.
idol idol worship in that sense. Like he's really taken this idea of someone that he sees other people hold a lot of admiration for and wants to kind of capture that for himself,
right?
Because of, you know, neglect and loneliness and trauma and all this and that. Definitely something I would say is not an easy watch.
Right. Probably not for everybody.
Definitely, yeah. Maybe check the content warnings on this one.
Yeah.
But
agreed. Did you see Elijah Bynum's first movie? It's called Hot Summer Nights. I think it had Timothée Chalamet in it.
No.
I haven't seen
it. I haven't.
Either.
That sounds familiar, though.
Yeah.
But no, I haven't seen it.
I'd be interested to see sort of how that movie plays out, given, mm-hmm. like, I don't know. And I think this movie has, I didn't dislike it. I think it's definitely a different experience watching this film than maybe, you know, a more typical or typically structured film. But it's, I'm not going to say it's bad or anything, but I do think that there's an interesting story about, like, you know, pushing yourself to that extreme, and this movie kind of glides along that path at times and diverges away from it too.
It's like sort of parallel to it. I don't think it really follows that much at all. It kind of is like focuses more on the divergences from it.
Yep.
You know, we see Killian when he has a particular failure, break his diet, you know,
yeah.
binge eat or starve himself or dehydrate himself. So mm-hmm. it's more about his relationship to trying to maintain the necessary,
right.
you know, sort of diet, I guess, or, you know, routines to improve his bodybuilding and like his physique. And then why and when he breaks that, like,
right.
really falls short. I think it was less than I expected, but as far as Jonathan Majors goes, 1,000 times
lived
more.
Up to the hype.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's going to be it for Magazine Dreams. Do you want to do a roundup on it before we close out?
Yeah, sure. 3.5.
Yeah, I give it 3. So this is probably going to be our only check-in from Sundance before it ends. But, yeah, check in with us next week, and we'll have a full rundown of the rest of the movies that we saw. All right, Zach, so we're going to close things out with another Regal mystery movie. So did we do a full review of Spirited when we did that mystery movie?
No, I think we kind of joked about maybe doing it. I think we were waiting for Cody to watch it, honestly.
Right. That sounds right.
And because he loves musicals.
That's true. That's a fact about our friend Cody. Yeah, so we're actually, no joking around here, we're going to talk about the latest Regal mystery movie that we went to see. And so I guess maybe let's set the table by explaining that last year Regal had a deal with Apple TV Plus to release some of their movies in a limited theatrical run. I wouldn't even call it a run, I guess. It was like a one-night engagement. One night
only, yeah.
Yeah, and so Regal, in their infinite wisdom, packaged these as a like monthly mystery movie or like quarterly mystery movie or whatever. They released consistently like a week before they hit Apple TV+. Everyone figured out exactly what it is by the time the second one came around, which was, of course, Spirited. And I would dare to say that people were generally not pleased. That I don't know. I felt like the sentiment I saw around the internet was that people thought they were being treated as idiots with these things, like trying to be tricked into thinking that it was the Fablemans, but instead it was the Ryan Reynolds, Will Ferrell dancing musical.
I think you just have to consider that the internet is a perpetual motion machine, and they will take an idea and run with it, right? Like, especially in terms of the communities that are that discuss Regal mystery movies, you know, it's mostly going to be Regal Unlimited members.
Yep.
Not even who are so chronically Regal attendees, like, or chronically like
movie pilled, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. That they're not necessarily going to consider the average consumer's perspective. We talked about this a little bit, I think, the last time we talked about Regal mystery movies, how this, the marketing behind this, this promotional campaign, because the mystery movie costs $5.
Yep.
And it's on a Monday night, and it's at, like, you know, prime movie going time, 7 o'clock. And for most people, unless they absolutely loathe whatever is on screen, is a pretty good deal.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Incredibly.
Get them in the door, buy some deal. Concessions. Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. And so, yeah, the internet detectives deduced that the first movie might be, you know, A, B, or C. The Greatest Beer Run Ever being the actual film that screened was one of those possibilities.
Right.
Then, because it was an Apple TV Plus release, Spirited, you know, being the next one, was that much more likely.
The sleuthing behind that was pretty impressive. You know, yeah. People finding, like, the code name that they used, the, like, working title.
And but then, you know, because you know, of the categories of information that you have available to you, the fact that Fablemans also fit in that box, people, I think, got their hopes up a little bit, maybe.
It's the hope that kills you.
Yeah, exactly. I was one of these people. I definitely was like, please be the Fablemans. But then, of course, it's Spirited because God hates me. But I wasn't that upset. Spirited is fine.
And, yeah.
You know, I saw it for free in theaters when normally it was streaming only release.
It might have been the only way you were going to see it.
That is also true. Yeah. Yes, that is also true.
So this year, Regal has brought back the campaign, and they have assured us that they will be working with more studios, and that these mystery movies will be including like major studio releases, and that was the case this time.
Yeah, given the reaction that it was like, oh, the only other two movie mysteries they had done had been Apple TV productions. Everyone was like, okay, what's the next one that Apple TV is producing? That's obviously the mystery movie. It's not so much a mystery anymore. On Twitter, Regal was like, no, this is, but we promise, this is a movie that has never been shown on screen before from a studio that is not Apple TV. please come watch. And so, yeah, that would be this movie.
Big reveal. Missing. Which is in some ways a sequel, in some ways sort of just like you mentioned off the top, a spiritual successor that takes place in the same universe to, I guess, what did we decide, 2018's Searching?
Yeah, I guess we can look that up.
Yeah, we can. And I think the thing, if, you know, I'm not sure Searching really left as big an impact as it maybe generated conversation at the time. But the thing behind that movie was it all took place on screens, right?
Yeah, I can't remember the name of, like, the software or whatever they use to do the screen recordings like this.
Yeah, 2018.
And like generations or, you know, generating these digital images.
Sure.
There's something that came out because I specifically listened to a podcast once with Anish Giganti, director of Searching, and his writing partner. I can't remember his name.
Oh, I had it
here. But I think they're Anish is a USC alum. That's right. Yeah. I think they're both maybe USC alums, or at least Anish is. But okay. I remember listening to this podcast and them talking about how when they got this deal to develop Searching, that was one of the things that it had made it possible to be able to make, sure, to produce a movie that is only perceived from screens like this, so to speak, like, you know, the FaceTime cams and,
right.
And talking about these little like artifacts, I guess, if you would say, that what it feels like to actually interact with screens as a person, like typing out a text that you delete or, sure, you know, clicking on certain boxes. In Missing particularly, they do this little fun bit with a CAPTCHA box, mm-hmm, that, you know, had our basically the entire audience laughing about, or like everyone knows that frustration of like,
right,
this is so this, close is to not, what a stoplight, yeah, is, like it's like just the tiniest corner of it or whatever, like does that count, kind of thing,
right?
So yeah, and I think at the time that Searching was released, that was sort of brand new and kind of cutting edge, you know. And then became a bit of a trend.
Yeah, so I listened to a podcast too with Anish Giganti around the time of the release of Run. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he was talking about, I wouldn't say that he sounded like necessarily remorseful about like Searching or anything, but I guess in a lot of the same ways that like some directors get their start in horror to sort of be able to build a case for themselves on a lower budget and then expand out with like the success that they find into, you know, more of their passion projects or that kind of thing. I wouldn't say that like his comments were so much like, I don't want to do this kind of thing, but definitely they were in the vein of like, yeah, I did this because this is the movie that could get made. And also like the bit of regret that he seemed to show was that, you know, all of these producers kept coming around and being like, okay, well, let's do Searching too. This was such a hit. Like, let's write the next screen movie. Like, you're the screen movie guy. And so he specifically went out of his way to make Run because he wanted to get out of that like box.
Right.
And so now here he is writing. He found a script, I guess, that he liked for this. Unofficially was Searching 2 before it landed on the title Missing. And obviously not directing here, but he and Sev Ohanian did write the script or consult on the script, story
there's
by
no
something
way
like that.
Yeah, so the way the WGA does credits written by is like the final pass,
right?
And then story by is a credit that you only need to give like if the original idea was inspired,
right?
So I imagine this is something that probably, you know, Anish and Sev worked on, or maybe even just the way that the guild rules are written, that because they wrote the original Searching, this which is,
you know, they were on the pre-show kind of like thank you for coming to our movie kind of thing.
That was the actors, wasn't it?
Anish Giganti was in there too, I think, and he has spoken about being involved in the movie, mm-hmm, too. So like somehow they were involved in the writing process,
right,
of it, but maybe not the credited writers.
Yeah, story by is such a not necessarily catch all, but like broad,
right,
credit that he could literally have said like it's almost like a like an IP thing or like,
right,
a, you know, a patent or something that like, oh, the idea of a movie only done on screens where someone goes missing,
right?
That's a story by Anish Giganti and Sever,
right,
something like that. It's a loose credit. So, yeah,
yeah.
I mean, obviously, I'm not an insider. I don't know exactly what happened. But I remember specifically seeing the credits and being like, oh,
yeah,
only story by. I assume that the studios made a decision that they're going to proceed with the sequel or whatever. So they,
yeah,
hired.
I might tell you a little something about this movie. But
different directors and a writing team.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's talk about this movie a little bit. So it follows a young girl. She's not like a, I guess she's a young woman, like a senior in high school. Okay, 17, 18. Kind of rebelling against her mother. Her mother has, I guess her father dies when she's very young. And she has this contentious relationship with her mother. Her mother is dating a new guy and goes away on vacation. She's supposed to go pick her mother up from the airport. And when she goes, nobody shows up. The mother and the boyfriend disappear, and she has no way to get a hold of them. So it's another sort of what happened to them, where did they go kind of mystery, in the vein of searching. Did I miss anything there?
No, I mean, that's pretty much it. If you've seen Searching, Missing pretty much hits the same beats and sort of narrative twists that you saw in Searching. Albeit different, like, you know, it's a completely different story.
Right.
But narratively speaking, in terms of story structure and like what you might be expecting from a studio trying to capitalize on the success of Searching, it gives you everything you're looking for.
Yeah.
Or you might expect.
You know what my first thought was watching this movie? Like, even before getting into all of the, you know, the way that it's shot and the way the story is told, is that these movies just don't, like, exist really anymore. We don't really get the missing person. And maybe it's, like, a January thing. Like, you get your, who's the guy, the Taken guy?
Liam Neeson?
Liam Neeson, like, thriller kind of thing.
Hmm.
But, I don't know, like, a twisty mystery of, like, someone's gone missing and now we have to, like, track them down kind of thing is not a movie you see a whole lot of, I feel like.
Yeah, I feel like maybe that kind of demand has shifted more to like true crime documentaries and series. Yeah. No, but I mean, like, I feel like
someone goes missing, we want the Batman to show up.
Netflix is still making those kind of things. They're just stuff that's going straight to Netflix, right. Not necessarily.
And disappearing like 5 seconds later.
Yeah, or it trends for, you know, a week,
right?
Depending how long it is, but yeah, I think maybe those are things that they're just we're not seeing a lot of. Yeah.
Well, so my second thought after that, first thought, wow, this kind of movie with like these twists and kind of turns aren't really getting made anymore. Second thought was, it really sucks that this is being told through FaceTime cameras. Like, I don't think that this is the most narratively tight movie missing. Like, it does twist and move about a lot. It's just not interesting anymore, you know?
Yeah, you're not really, like, the humanity that you're experiencing in the movie is sort of just a reflection of your own, in a right. sense. Like those little interactions I'm talking about with, you know, how you interact with your phone or your social media logins and things like that. Like, definitely little reminders of daily life that give this feeling or give this film a sense of feeling and like gravity, you know, like some weight behind it, like a haptic, like some haptic feedback, right? Sure. That's what this film gives you. But yeah, it's a little bit more difficult to give a shit.
Yeah.
Especially if you're coming from me, I really love Searching. Like, I like Searching a lot as a film. And when I first watched it, I thought it was so cool.
Yeah.
And I've seen it a few times. It's something that I've really watched.
Does it hold up? Last time you watched it?
3 or 4 times. Hold up, I think, is yeah, for me at least, it does.
Right.
You know, and I like John Cho's performance in it, which I think is something that's lacking here. Storm Reid is fine, but
she is, but she's not like not a really movie star to the same degree that John Cho is, I guess.
Yeah. And it's really hard, I think, for any sequel ever, spiritual or otherwise, to recreate the feeling of watching something for the first time that feels like original or right. new, like some like Searching did. And yeah, this does not live up at all. It feels almost paint by numbers compared to
right.
the original.
It does. It feels almost like we gotta hit our twist at this point. Like mm-hmm. we've gotta throw some subversion in, and you kind of just know it's coming. Like, I don't know.
And not to just like completely write this film off. I think it's fine. It's not a bad movie, so to speak. Like,
yeah.
It's okay. And I mean, we saw this for free. good enough.
Right.
You know, even paying $5 for it would probably be a lot of fun, especially if you're just like an average moviegoer who doesn't go that often. And to its credit, it does, as a mystery thriller, it's everything that you would want, right? There are some tense moments in this, even if you don't necessarily care about the fate of these characters. Like, there's some moments here that are thrilling.
Yeah, so this is the problem that I have. So I was much more down on Searching than you were, I think, at the time. Kind of viewing it in the same way I view this movie, is that, like, the movie itself, like, the story you're trying to tell would actually be better served by just being a story, you know? Like, you can include some of the technological stuff, but by making it exclusively on the screen of a computer, like, for Missing specifically, like, that basically requires Storm Reed's character to go to bed every night with her laptop, like, on her lap open, you know, just to kind of have some of the emotion that you're trying to get out of that character.
Sure.
Come through on the screen. And I think, I guess, mild spoiler, I won't get into exactly what happens, but there is this big climactic confrontation towards the end of the movie, and it's all told through a security camera that makes you feel like you are a mile away from what's happening.
Right.
And it's terrible. Like, this whole movie is building around this mother-daughter relationship and, like, realizing the things that they're keeping from each other. And they finally come together and have this moment, and you feel like you're watching it on, like, a grainy, like, you are. You're watching it on a grainy, like, security camera feed, and it's none of the emotional work that the characters or the actors are bringing to the stage here comes through on that camera. At least for me, I felt like I was really taken out of a lot of the scenes. Like, the only scenes that actually kind of worked for me was she meets a guy named Javi.
Yeah.
In Colombia, and Javi, he's just kind of, like, fumbling with his phone on FaceTime, and, like, he's a funny guy. Like, those work, but
yeah,
it's when you're actually trying to deliver, like, an emotional climax, like a good movie like this should have, telling it through the screen of a camera, like, on a secondary, like, there's a distance that is created between the audience and the scene that you're portraying, and it's just a bummer.
That's a good point. I think the sort of the, I mean, not to go too deep into spoilers, I guess, but some of the themes that this movie is exploring aren't present in Searching, you know, in terms of abuse and domestic violence. And so, yes, what you're saying about the emotional climax and, like, even the narrative climax of this movie taking place on like a Ring camera is undercut a bit by that medium. Whereas in Searching, that's not necessarily the case. It's more like he's watching a live stream. You see his emotional reaction to a live stream and sort of putting the puzzle pieces together, and then it cuts to, like, a news story of the aftermath. Sure. Yeah, so I can totally see that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's been a while since I've seen
valid
Searching.
Valid criticism.
But I do remember that as being sort of like John Cho being almost foreign to the technological world that his daughter inhabits, too.
Yes, yeah.
And so it's not just him, you know. It felt more tethered to the actual story at hand. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't feel, with Missing, again, and not to just, like, crap on this movie the whole time, because, like you said, I think it is at least a competent movie, and, like, that's kind of all you can ask for out of a January release. But I do think that this is a movie that doesn't have to be this way. Like, there's nothing about this story that really feels like it had to be told in this way, whereas Searching, it did really feel like it was making some amount of commentary on the sort of generational divide and, like, technology as a place to exist in and of itself, like, in a way that this one doesn't so much.
Yeah. This one is more, so Searching originally is much more a story about a father's disconnectedness with his daughter, and exactly like you're saying, the generational divide, and, like, how much more young people today are, like, involved with technology, having grown up with it, right?
Because
as sort of, like, on the middle end or towards the younger end of the millennial generation, we're right on this cusp of technology where we remember not always having it all the time, but people younger than us have always had technology, right? Like the prevalence of it. And so yeah, there's that. That is definitely explored in searching. Whereas in missing, it's, what's the, I'm trying to think of like the best way to say it, but essentially the biggest difference is that this movie feels empty, I guess, in a way. It feels like a studio trying to recapture the success of the original.
Right.
That, you know, they're not, it's not really trying. One thing that I guess that's present here that isn't in the original is more commentary on like society itself. Sure. There's a recreation of, and again coming back to Netflix and like their true crime obsession.
What was that series called?
I don't remember what it's called either, but it's like recreations of
true crime,
true crime. Yeah, and one of them being the original Searching Case, which is what our protagonist Storm Reid character is watching. And then, of course, they get their own episode later. And
which, honestly, is the best scene in the movie to me, is like when they finally wrap things up.
Yeah.
And then, like, they show it in this cinematic way. Like,
yeah.
I'm like, okay, now we're at a movie. Like, this why couldn't the whole thing be this?
Yeah. And also how, like, society will run with the story. This is slightly present in Searching, where they're, like, accusing the dad of doing something
right.
gross to his daughter or whatever. But it feels much more personal in this one. There's no like her best friend questions her mother's reliability and, mm-hmm. and mental faculties. And then, yeah, that like recreation, that dramatization at the end, it reminded me of, Unbearable Weight, Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, right?
Okay. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Where at the end, the climax of that one, it transitions to like this recreation.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very funny, but gave me a similar vibe at the end of this one.
Yeah. So again, missing as, I don't know, I guess we both kind of agree it doesn't stand up to what Searching was doing for a lot of the reasons we laid out here. I feel like we've been pretty harsh on this movie. Is there anything you want to throw in that, like, you know, I like we said, I think same thing for, you know, $5, it was worth it, but I don't know that it's worth to go like spend a full like price movie ticket.
Yeah. So I think what can be said, you know, positively is that it's still a fun movie, and is like a good mystery thriller, right?
Yeah.
If you enjoyed Searching, I think you would still enjoy Missing, even though it might feel a little bit lacking, like for, mm-hmm. for you and I.
I think it
definitely, as far as my opinion of this being the studio just trying to recreate their original success, I think that hits all the marks that it needs to be an achievement in that regard.
Right.
But given the landscape that movies are in now, and theater attendance as well, I don't know if that this is actually going to.
Yeah. I haven't looked to see the box office
financially do anything. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's also kind of the only new thing playing right now too. Mm-hmm. Like, in the last week, I think what can also be said is that if you're into a mystery kind of movie, this is not a regal mystery movie, but like a mystery genre movie. This is the kind of movie that you probably won't guess necessarily where it's going. Like, I think there were a lot of twists in here.
Right.
But I don't think I pegged exactly what was going to happen until, you know, pretty close to when it did. So if you're into that kind of thing, then this might be the movie for you.
Yeah. And for people who maybe, this might do the rounds of like people who haven't seen the original Searching, you know, younger audiences, maybe very much Storm Reid is like a Gen Z character.
Right.
That's not necessarily present in the original and Searching. So yeah, I think I ended up giving it like 3 stars, which is, you know, it's fine. It's a good movie.
Yeah, I guess we do have to round it up. So 3 stars for you. Is listed as a direct sequel on Letterboxd here. I gave it 2 stars. I wasn't a big fan of Searching in the first place. And I think, kind of like you said, this is just doing Searching, but worse. And, I don't really have a lot of time for that. So 2 stars.
Yeah, solid 3 for me. It's fine.
So go see Missing?
Sure. All right. If you don't mind missing $15 or whatever.
All right, Zach, that is going to do it for this week's episode of Spinning the Reel. Where can people find us?
As always, on spinningthereel.com, R-E-E-L, mm-hmm. And Letterboxd. I am painted_dog.
And I'm EvanD26. Check back here next week. I'm not sure what the big movie coming out this week is. Any ideas?
Infinity Pool, I think, is like the biggest release.
Well, we'll see about that one. but at least we will have a rundown of Sundance and the rest of the movies that we have on deck. There's a whole nother 9 of them that we'll be getting to before next week's episode. And then, you know, whatever else we decide to talk about.
Yeah, maybe some more Oscar preview stuff. There's a lot of exciting things happening right now.
Movies. We'll be right back.